I am Plata on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. Alan Levine joins me again. The distinguished writer and historian has written a new book, Details Are Unprintable, Wayne Lonergan and the Sensational Cafe Society Murder. It's about the October 1943 murder of a young woman and mother, Patricia Burton Lonergan. She was a scion of a wealthy German-Jewish family who loved the good life in Manhattan. Charged with the murder is her estranged husband, one Wayne Lonergan of Toronto. The arrest and trial of Lonergan causes a sensation in the American press, as it does in Canada. It's a sort of story that has everything the public wants, sex, murder, and money. It literally knocks the Second World War from the front pages of the newspapers. Alan does a tremendous job with his research, providing a lot of context of the players involved, but also the society and its mores of the day. He also provides those breathless, salacious headlines in the press of the day that all too often shape the public's perception of the people at the fore. It's a great book, and I'll get Alan to tell us as much as he'd like, because though details can be looked up, it's likely a story few will know. Alan Levine is an award-winning author of such books as Coming of Age, A History of Jewish People of Manitoba, King, William Lyon Mackenzie King, A Life Guided by the Hand of Destiny, Toronto, Biography of a City, Seeking the Fabled City, The Canadian Jewish Experience, and Scrum Wars, among many other books, including the Sam Klein Mysteries series. Visit alanlevinebooks.com for more information. We taped this interview in late October, just after Alan received an honorary degree from the University of Winnipeg. This new book is published by Lions Press, an imprint of Roman and Littlefield. Please welcome back to the Plante Online program, Alan Levine. Mr. Levine, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Do you remember when it was that you first found out about the Lonergan story?
I do. I've been searching for a true crime story for a long time. I've always been sort of somewhat fascinated by the genre, and you know, even in movies and particularly, you know, that period of the 1940s, 50s. And in my searching on, you know, the internet where you find these things, I came across 1948, October 1948, Cosmopolitan article by the great Raymond Chandler that caught my eye, and it was called 10 Greatest Crimes of the Century. And in that, he details, sort of in a list form almost, his 10 favorite, or what he considered to be the 10 greatest crimes. And the first one was the Lindbergh case, the kidnapping of Charles Lindbergh's son and the killing of the little boy. And so forth. And then I started investigating, which I knew there had been books about, and I started investigating each one. And a couple of them are more familiar to me than others. And then I came across number 9 is this case about Wayne Lonergan from Toronto, which interested me right away, who was charged with killing his young wife in 1943, October 1943. In fact, you know, this week that we're talking. And I started digging around, and it intrigued me, and I found that there was possibilities for a book, that there had been two books about the case, but one in 1955, by a TV columnist, and another 1972, which was more a little more involved than in just like the 55 book was just basically newspaper stories, because there had there were tons of newspaper stories about the case that I soon found out, and I realized that the 1972 book was interesting because the person who had written it had actually interviewed Lonergan, Wayne Lonergan, and but I started reading the book, and then it didn't, you know, it's good, but it's written in the 1970s. So the thing that really cemented, to be honest, the whole thing was that I thought I could do this book and tell the story, but I needed some more information, and I got access to what the person in 1970 could never have got access to was the district attorney's files. I tracked them down to the New York Record Office or New York Municipal Archives, and people there were really helpful, and they went in and they found this massive several boxes of files that had not been opened since 1943-44, or actually the 60s, because someone there had been something in the 60s. So I guess someone had looked at it up into the 60s. But the documents themselves were from 1943-44, and they detailed in fantastic, just fantastic stuff. Everything you possibly wanted to know about the case. It was the police reports, witness statements, biographical information, the financial records of the deceased, the murder scene, the medical examiner's report. It was, to me, like from a historian's point of view, it's like I struck gold, and I got it all digitized and sent to me here and in Winnipeg where I live, and that's how the book took shape. And as soon as I started reading the stuff, I knew that there is more to the story than either of the books or any other news stories over the years. There, people had been, it was one of those kind of things that can keep coming up in tabloids about the case. And then that's how it sort of happened.
Now, I'm having a great deal of fun reading it. I'm wondering what it was like for you. I mean, what was it fun? Because it sort of seems like
it. And I have to say, you and I have talked about a couple of my other books. Yeah. They're all big and massive books, the last couple, which required massive amounts of research and this to me was so. I was looking for something more concentrated, and though I delved into, the New York life scene, issues about the show Social Life, morality, because as you know that plays a part of the issues about homosexuality in the 1940s, which I somewhat had read about and was familiar with a bit. So it was much more contained as a story, and though I did have to delve into legal issues, because the case itself involves certain issues around confessions and police behavior that was fun too, and I ended up communicating with all sorts of legal scholars across the U.S. and mainly who were more than happy to speak to me about these kind of issues, and I discovered, New York state law was different, and I guess to a certain extent still is, than other states in the way it treated defendants, and so that was a good learning experience for me too.
So Wayne Lonergan, as you mentioned, Alan was Canadian. Well, what do we need to know about his heritage or his upbringing? Say,
well. He was born in Toronto in 1918, the year the World War I ended, and he grew up in a relatively middle class family. His father worked for a insurance company, I suppose they lived near downtown Toronto, not too far from Bathurst and Bloor, a nice area. Mm-hmm. But I think the main thing in his life was that his mother was what we would call bipolar. And she had many problems throughout her life. Both his parents died relatively young, and so he was impacted by that. He had some older siblings too, and he was the youngest. And he found himself getting into trouble at a young age, juvenile delinquents kind of stuff. He went from a couple schools, he's a guy who's in search of himself. And as you know, because you've read the book, there is issues about his sexual identity that I believe played a part in developing his character. And so he was always striving to figure that out, and it was impossible to do so in the 1930s when he grew up.
Right.
He had several jobs, and none of them, that was the other thing. In the files, the police files were actual, reference letters and reports about Wayne's job in Toronto as a lifeguard. I mean, you couldn't really find anything. You couldn't find that kind of stuff.
Wow.
You got a so-so report because he was always going off on a motorboat with friends instead of doing his job. That sort of says something about him. And he wanted the good life, I guess.
Yeah.
And so that's how he ended up in New York City in 1939. He got a job at the New York World's Fair through Greyhound Bus Lines that was operating a transit system at the fair, which was at the time this fantastic world event and attracting all sorts of attention. And that's how he ended up there, and that's how the story really, he ends up meeting Patricia Burton Lonergan's father, William, and that's how the story begins. That's how he ends up meeting her as well.
So that family, it's a well-to-do family compared to him who's working for the bus,
right?
Yeah,
he comes from, as I said, middle class, and they are fabulously wealthy. She comes from her father, this William Burton.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, the family's name was Bernheimer. they were the I guess William's grandfather was a Jewish immigrant from Germany and established a beer brewery business at a time when that was really popular and became really successful. And when he died, the business passed on to William's father, who also built up the business further and, you know, advertised and did very well. There's a real, the kind of beer they made was really popular. And so, but he died, William's father died also rather young. It runs in the family, of a heart problem. And so William inherited a massive amount of money for the time when he turned 21. And at the time, that was like in 1917, and it was during the First World War, and German Jews were looking, I mean, part of it was there was an anti-German sentiment because of the war, but also German Jews were looking to distance themselves from the masses of East European and Russian Jews who lived in the Lower East Side of New York and were a highly visible minority. So, like many German Jews, the Bernheimers, William and his brother George changed their name to Burton. But it's not like they were fooling anybody. He then, you know, he didn't really have to work. He sort of fancied himself an artist. But he was also probably gay, which is, or bisexual, which is also part of the story that I can say. And, and he, but in the 1920s, you know, his family ends up forcing him to, or he's compelled to marry a woman from Lucille. Her name is Lucille Wolf. She comes from a Southern Jewish family who had lost a lot of money. They were also really rich, except the Civil War killed them, and the family sort of suffered after that financially. But Lucille comes from, you know, that kind of background. She was highly educated, and she ends up marrying William in a marriage that was doomed to failure, much like her daughters. Yeah. And they have one child, Patricia, who's born in 1921. And that is, you know, and Patricia is brought up in wealth, and the family spends half the year in the south of France. They have a villa there. William fancied himself an artist, and he, you know, painted in Paris. And the mother and the father, Lucille and William, eventually get divorced, and then, strangely enough, remarry, which I thought was kind of strange.
Yeah.
But she apparently did it for Patricia. And Patricia's spoiled, but she's young, and she's probably no different than the child of any wealthy family. She's brought up by nannies, mainly. Mm-hmm. And she does, you know, she's a debutante, I call her. She belonged to that kind of society, having, you know, lunch at the Waldorf Astoria with her friends and going to balls. And at some point, you know, her father, in 1939, meets Wayne Lonergan at the World's Fair, or is introduced to him at a hotel. There's two stories, and they more than likely had an intimate relationship.
Uh-huh.
And then William introduces Wayne to his daughter, who then starts dating. They start dating, and things may have been different, but William dies in 1940, also of a heart attack, 1940, and. Then Wayne and Patricia's relationship continues to the point where they eventually, much against Lucille, the mother Lucille's wishes, they run away to Las Vegas and elope.
Yeah, so Patricia says something about...
the famous line is, you know, and I don't know if it's true, it's actually from a column. You know, the case attracted a massive amount of media attention. That's probably also why it's interesting. But there's, you know, in days without Twitter and other social media, the gossip columns of the tabloid, they try to outdo each other with juicy details. And you know, there's a lot of information, a lot of nonsense, really. I didn't know, for example, as a fan of Ed Sullivan,
Beatles
in 1964. Ed Sullivan had a great gossip columnist, and that's how he started out. And he was writing stuff about this case as well. Walter Winchell, I guess, is the most famous. And so they wrote all sorts of things. But one of the columnists, a woman, wrote that apparently Patricia at one point says, you know, if he's good enough for my father, he's good enough for me. It's a great line if it's true.
Yeah.
I don't know, but I, you know, I include it in the book. And the other thing about the Burdens is, or Patricia and Wayne to a certain extent, is this is also a period of time in which going to the Stork Club and the El Morocco and the 21 Club, which were part of something called New York Cafe Society, which, to be fair, I didn't know a lot about either before I started this. And I guess because it was New York and a certain mystique grew about these clubs, a little larger than life, Hollywood and Broadway stars frequented them. And as far as I can tell, it's really a bunch of rich people going out every night or every second night and spending oodles of money and drinking champagne. And Prohibition also was during this period. So, I mean, the nightclubs were doing it somewhat secretly before 33 when Prohibition was then rescinded. It took off a lot. So the period between 1934 and the early 40s, where when the murder takes place, is really its heyday.
Yeah.
And it was constantly in the news, and people were constantly doing stories about who was where. And this is where, you know, paparazzi came from, from this period of time. You know, getting your picture taken at the Star Club but was a really big deal. I mean, they were a little more respectful back then.
Yeah.
You know, the key photographer was a guy named Jerome Zerbe, who was hired by the clubs to take pictures of famous people and where you sat in the club, and there were certain special rooms that only high profile people could go into, and the owners of the clubs themselves also became really famous, and New York and Patricia and Wayne were part of that scene for a while. She was just an up and coming young woman, but she liked going to the clubs. And in fact, on the night before she was murdered, she was at a club, and so was he.
Yeah.
They were already, their marriage had fallen apart a bit, and they were separated, though not divorced, and never did get divorced. But they were on with other people at the time.
I want to talk about Cafe Society, the marvelous Jerome Kern song. Whose lyric I'm going to borrow from, you know, he mentions El Morocco and the Stork and the other stay-up-late cafes. If you're like me, a fan of old Hollywood, you look at photos of celebrities.
Yes.
They're at the Stork Club, and that ashtray is there. And
for
years, I wanted one, and so I finally bought one off of eBay, and it's sitting in front of me.
You can get, and the El Morocco had striped zebra-like. At chairs, which was all, were also famous. They have live music, and a lot of good food, it was hard to get into these places. The doormats of these clubs were like guardians of some kind of fortress.
Yeah.
You had to have reservations, or at least be a who's who kind of a person. I searched. You know, the only place that still exists is the 21 Club,
right,
which I did go into, and which somewhat, I was told, looks the same as it did in the 1940s, but the other places are long gone. The poor Stork Club is now a burger joint on a cement park.
Yeah.
And there's nothing, no one even knows. People, it's funny, you know, they don't, unless you're really sort of digging into the history of the city, it's long forgotten.
I walk, I can't remember what street it's on, but I walked past it as I was going somewhere a few years ago. They have a plaque there on one of the cement walls.
Right, that's right. CBS ended up buying property, I think.
That's right, yeah, Bill Paley. Yeah. What was it about this sort of, I mean, I can see the appeal of it. I mean, I watch old movies like, you know, with that Hitchcock movie where the guy worked at the Stork Club.
Yes.
I can see why that sort of place and time was so appealing to both Patricia and Wayne. Was that something that they because they weren't celebrities per se. I mean, was that something that they wanted?
Look, from Wayne's point of view, he suddenly had money. And that was the other thing. I mean, he comes from nothing. He doesn't work until he actually joins the Royal Canadian Air Force, which is near the end of but just before the murder. He's not working really. He sort of tries to be a photographer or a photographer's assistant for a while in New York. And he does take some classes and he does have some work. And he does a few other odd jobs and things, but nothing really steady. I mean, he plays bridge with Somerset Maugham and other famous people that his in-laws happen to know. And he's living living in luxury compared to where he's ever lived before. After they got married, they lived at 983 Park Avenue, I think was an address. And I walked by the place. I mean, it was fabulously. It's beautiful. And I was just thinking when I walked by there, and I was there in, like, I guess would have been 2019. I was thinking, God, from Wayne's point of view, this must have been like, living in the Taj Mahal or something from his, because it was so gorgeous. And he, he obviously was more than happy to indulge in this kind of lifestyle. And she was 22. He was a couple years older. And her friends were there, and they partied and danced. And when she, even after she had, they had a little boy who was born in 42. Uh-huh. The kid was about 18 months old when the murder took place. Patricia had a live-in nanny as she had moved to this place on 51st Street where the murder took place, a townhouse. And she, even though she was a good mother, and my impression is she loved her kid, she, wouldn't have considered changing her plans because of her child. And, the night that she was, just as an example, on the night that she was murdered, Saturday, October 23rd, 1943, she left her house at 2:30 in the afternoon to go see friends. She doesn't come back till approximately 6:30 in the morning on Sunday. I mean, you think about that. Yeah. She has a kid, an 18-month-old kid who's being taken care of by a nanny. I mean, that was the lifestyle that she led. And Wayne claimed that he frowned. She was more of a partier than he was. I'm not so sure that was true. He also lied a lot. Yeah. My viewpoint anyway.
How much of Patsy's death do you want to tell us about?
Well, it's not unknown, and in fact, the book itself, if you just read about it, even the part in the cover, it does tell you. I mean, she was found. She came home from being on a date with this Italian decorator named Gavellini, who was quite a bit older than her, but I guess he probably wanted some of her money too. But I should add that she was, because her father had died, she was like this, and her uncle had also died. She's a sole beneficiary of the brewery business. Her grandmother Stella was still alive, getting old, and in fact she died in 1954. At the time in 1943. The estate, Stella, was probably worth about $7 million in the 1940s, which would have been the equivalent of like $60 to $70 million today.
Wow.
Patricia had inherited some money from her father, who had some properties, and she didn't have to work either. Her monthly income in her investments and other things was enough to sustain both her and Wayne. But she also had out there to some unbelievable amount of money that she would have got someday. It turned out that their kid, his name was Billy, he got all the money when the grandmother died, or his great-grandmother died. Mm-hmm. That's how it happened. So she comes home, and the medical examiner determined the door of her bedroom remained shut. Well, I'll just tell you quickly what happened, and the door of her bedroom remained shut. She was supposed to go into the country. So the nanny was home all day with the kid, although she went out periodically for walks.
Uh-huh.
And the bedroom door remained shut, and she knocked a few times, but there was no answer. Because I tell this in the prologue, and it's been on, it's not a big deal. Yeah. There was another family living on the third and fourth floor of the place. They actually had a ground floor and four floors. Patricia had the ground floor. It's a beautiful brownstone, but it stood outside of it. And it's got four floors, so she had the first two floors, essentially, with the ground floor for a three-floor apartment, and there's a family of a bureaucrat from Washington whose family lived there. And they had a maid, their nurse, looking after that, a son who was sick at the time. Anyways, on that Sunday morning around 9 o'clock, the maid, this nurse rather, her name was Annalise, she went down to a common area to get the paper, and she heard a woman screaming. Patricia, because the bedroom was on this, there's this common area near Patricia's bedroom, which had a door on that exit of that place, too. And she didn't do anything, she didn't hear anything else, she didn't hear a man's voice, nothing. She just heard some screaming, fighting, then silence, and then another scream, and nothing else. She didn't call the police, she was 21, 22.
Yeah.
She should have. And that was the end of that. And all day, so no one tell anybody about this. And by around early evening that Sunday, October 24th, the nanny was getting concerned. She called Patricia's mother, Lucille, who lived nearby. She was living on her own, and she came over. And eventually, with the help of a young male friend that happened to phone, and he was asked to come over, they ended up getting the bedroom door off the hinges and getting into the room, because the door was locked for some reason, which is a question I hadn't, I don't quite understand how that happened, but anyways, when they got into the bedroom, they discovered Patricia half naked, her head bludgeoned, and she's sort of half on the bed, and then the police are called, that's how the investigation. They discover, as I said, Wayne had joined the Royal Canadian Air Force. Why he did this is interesting in itself.
He tried to get out of joining the U.S.
Right, because even if he was a Canadian, he was still eligible for the American draft, which is kind of fascinating.
Yeah.
But he got out of it. Here's another one of his. Yeah, he got out of it by admitting to being homosexual, and which at the time the U.S. Army was, I'd use the description as pathologically paranoid about admitting any homosexuals into the U.S. Army, and so he gets out of it, and I have a whole section in the book about that issue because it's relevant to Wayne's story, and people did lie about it, and the literature of the time is worth looking into because it just shows you how backward, the views they held about homosexuality is so backward, and it shapes the way in which Wayne was portrayed. So he decides to, once their marriage is over, although he thinks they're going to get back together, he goes to Toronto and he enlists in the Royal Canadian Air Force, and is training in Toronto near university. It's a part of a U of T or University of Toronto program, and he's able to come home once or twice to see his son, and the weekend of October 22nd to 24th, he is in New York, wearing his uniform, and he stays at a very wealthy friend's house or apartment on 79th Street. A guy named John Hargis, who's family has big roots in the banking business and is fabulously wealthy. He's another person Wayne came into contact with, and for some reason, the hardest guy who had common sense and so forth, had befriended Wayne. And Wayne is in New York, so as soon as the police discover that Wayne had been there and had left, he left Sunday night, but had seen his son during that weekend, even though he didn't see Patricia, supposedly, they decide that he's certainly a person of interest, and they send New York detectives and a deputy ADA, or a district attorney, deputy assistant district attorney, to New York to investigate and question Lonergan. And, they asked the Toronto police to detain him, even though he hasn't been charged with a crime.
Yeah.
So on Monday morning, October 25th, the police arrive. And lo and behold, Wayne can't produce his Air Force uniform, which other people had noted on Sunday. Sunday, later that Sunday afternoon, when after she had been, let's assume she had been murdered about 9 in the morning on that Sunday. He saw people that Sunday afternoon before flying off to Toronto. He had borrowed some of Hargis' clothes that didn't fit him properly, and his uniform was missing. And he never really did answer what happened to the uniform, which is central, I guess, to the story of the case. And the police in Toronto detain him, even though, again, he's not been charged. And there was some outcry from some Toronto lawyers about why Wayne had been detained without a lawyer, though the story is that he never asked for a lawyer, mm-hmm. even though his uncle wanted to provide one. I think the Toronto police screwed it up a little bit here, or weren't quite above board in the way they treated him. But he eventually, the New York detectives and DA people come to New York, and Wayne agrees to accompany them back to New York. Yeah, even though they have to, at one point, handcuff him because they get stuck in Buffalo and they didn't want him to run away.
Yeah.
Again, not having been charged with a crime.
Yeah.
So he gives them this fantastical story, again revolving around homosexuality. And that story, his alibi, leads to because the press get a hold of that. He later recants the confession about having an intimate relationship with an American soldier who allegedly stole his uniform.
Yeah.
That leads to a fantastic headline, which I'm going to tweet about tomorrow, because I've been doing tweets this week about each day of the case. But October 28th, the Daily News in New York, a great tabloid, has this huge, almost the whole cover of the front page is called Lonergan Alibi Twisted Sex, and that taints Wayne's image forever, and he's very upset about it, and he doesn't ask for a lawyer, and they sort of make a deal with him to tell them what really happened, and so he ultimately does. He tells them that the story with the soldiers, there's just too many holes in it, but it paints a picture of him. And it leads to a betrayal of him that never really stopped, and I believe tainted the jury's and everybody in the press mentions it, and it's so there's like sort of two stories going on here. One is really the murder story and how the trial that I write about, and then there's this other kind of in the background is the social era and the morality issues of the time. And so you see what happened. I mean, sometimes I think we haven't moved beyond. My philosophy has always been, since I wrote a book about this many years ago, is that, we've moved forward in time, two steps forward, one step back.
Right.
And the U.S. right now, with Barrett's nomination and the conservative Supreme Court, is like a couple steps back.
Mm-hmm.
But if you think about where we were in the 1940s compared to where we are now, we're so much more ahead, even though the U.S. has a strong strain of conservatism that Canada doesn't have.
Yep.
But I do believe that it will continue to move forward, despite I'm not one of those who believe that the U.S. is going to turn the clock back to the 1920s and 30s and that the court will ultimately reflect attitudes that are current as opposed to really, really conservative attitudes that are in a minority, but that's another whole issue. But it's sort of part of the same story, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, it's marvelous to read the book because you see the morality, the hypocrisy, and how that trickles down to, say, what daily life is like in a city like New York.
Mm-hmm.
As you mentioned, it is a sensational trial. And all this is going on while the Second World War was happening, which I find fascinating because it dominates the pages of the news, even though there's a war going on overseas.
Yeah, well, it did, in fact, push it. Yeah, I mean, it becomes the number one news story for several, when he's first when he's first involved in question, but then the trial takes place in February. There's two trials. One was somewhat declared a mistrial. But February 44, then it occupies another 3 or 4 months of news coverage. Yes, yeah, so they couldn't see, and it's not only in New York. I mean, because I have access to newspapers.com and other website databases, you can see that it was covered like in every little town and city across the U.S. and in Canada. The Globe and Mail, the Star, they were all interested in the story. People did comment about how the war was sort of not as didn't seem more important, but that's just the way it is.
Yeah, the Lonergan serves time. Is found guilty.
Yeah, he eventually is. Yeah, I mean, I could say he does confess because he doesn't. He wants the stories about his sexuality to stop.
Right,
and so he offers his confession. There's then a question of whether the confession was freely given. I deal with that, and that's why I get into this whole issue about how confessions are treated in a New York court. And he is found guilty. Because DNA is far into the future, fingerprint analysis was weak. Uh-huh. Blood grouping that they did use was there, but not really relevant because, you know, they could identify a person's blood type in 1943, but so what?
Yeah.
Half the people on the planet had a certain blood O or something, you know?
Yeah.
So that was not important. So the fingerprints would have helped, but for whatever reason, the fingerprints they had weren't even introduced. So he is convicted mainly on the confession and on their attitude that he was guilty. And the confession itself is, I deal with a lot in the book, and it's based on the actual confession taken down by the stenographer in the room in New York. So it's as accurate. It's highly detailed and way too detailed for anybody to make up. So in my mind, he was not coerced, nor was he physically abused or anything like that.
Right. What did you find out about his life in Toronto after all this?
Right. Well, yeah, he's deported. He serves 22 years in two New York prisons, Sing Sing and Dan Mora, or Clinton Prison, I think it's called.
Uh-huh.
And he's taken back to Toronto, and he ends up finding, strangely enough, Barbara Hamilton, a famous actress. He finds another woman to look after him,
uh-huh.
and they're a couple, so to speak, for the rest of his life. He dies in 1986 of cancer. I have to say two things about that. One, I interviewed Gordon Pinsent, who knew Barbara Hamilton's friend,
uh-huh.
and remembers Lonergan, and who's very quiet, and no one ever talked about the case, and Barbara Hamilton always was a jovial kind of woman, always thought that Wayne was fantastic and had been framed. So that was good.
Yeah.
And his daughter Leah Pinsent, who would have been about 12 at the time when this would have been like the late 70s,
uh-huh.
she told me also in an interview that she found Wayne very creepy,
mm.
which is probably much more relevant.
Yeah.
Wayne himself, he never really talked much. In 1965, he was interviewed by the show This Hour is 7 Days.
Oh, yeah.
And I tracked down the audio files, not just of the show, but the complete two-hour interview that the show is based on.
Mm-hmm.
And I was able to hear him talk, and he had this really thick Brooklyn accent, you know, using the phrase "forget about it." You know, he sounds like some gangster from the '40s. But I guess having spent time in New York prisons for 20 years, he adopted the accent. So, but they ask him eventually. The guy who interviewed him is also he's in his 80s right now. I also spoke to him, and he does remember the interview. And he said he asked Wayne, you know, did you kill your wife? And, you know, Wayne's famous answer was, my position at this time is no. But he never also, so that was funny in a strange way, but he also never mentions Patricia's name once in the entire interview. It's always just my wife or her. And I thought that was kind of intriguing.
Yeah.
Just listening to him, my opinion of him as a liar never changed.
Right.
Recently, actually, his family contacted me. They didn't know a lot about the case. This would have been the grandchildren of his older brother, Joe. I can't remember his first name, but older brother.
Yeah, yeah.
And they didn't know. They had seen something about my book in the Toronto papers, and they wanted to know more about it. They didn't really talk much about it. The people who knew about it the most were their grandfather and grandmother, and the grandfather had died many years ago, and the grandmother did know, but she just actually died recently. I've been trying to find them, but I didn't know that there was a name change, and they lived outside of Toronto, and I couldn't find any name, and unfortunately I couldn't talk to her. I would have liked to have talked to her. She would have told me, I'm sure, something.
Did you try to find the son, Billy?
I did. I thought about it. Um, I I decided not to in the end. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure I found him. I believe I know where he is. He would have been like, he's like 78, 79 now. Dominic Dunn had written about the case in a Vanity Fair. He wrote about true crime for Vanity Fair, and he included the story of Lonergan in a book that he published around 2001. And he used the information from that book from the 1970s. He did speak to a few people who knew about the case, so those people are long gone, so I was able to use some of those comments. But he says that he didn't try to find him either. He decided that, I mean, what would this person know? You know, he never apparently saw Wayne again, mm-hmm. at least according to what I've been told or read. And he never knew his mother, doesn't remember her. All he knows is that his father is accused of killing his mother and was found guilty of it. So I don't know. I decided I sometimes feel like I should have talked to him. But I'm not sure that he wouldn't have wanted to talk to me about it, and maybe he's not, you know, maybe, I don't know if he knows about the book or would even read it.
Mm-hmm.
It's
such an engrossing book. I can't tell you how much I'm enjoying it.
Well, that's good.
And I can't wait to finish it. I before I let you go, I ought to congratulate you. I guess you received an honorary degree from the University of Winnipeg recently.
I did, it was very surprising. An honorary doctor of laws. Unfortunately, the whole thing was done virtually the other day. I had to tape record my speech to the graduates. And then they did the whole thing online, so it wasn't quite the same thing, I guess. But I know I feel very honored, and I was surprised by the professor I knew, acquaintance, decided to start the nominating process some months ago, and I was sort of taken aback by it. Yeah, it was very nice.
So you can call yourself doctor now, right?
That's doctor. Well, I have a PhD.
Oh, you do.
Already,
yeah, that's right. Yeah.
I told my kids, yes, they can call me doctor.
What's next for you, Alan?
I don't know. You know, you're asking me at a time when selling books is extremely difficult.
Mm.
It's hard. Unless your name is Barack Obama, I think, or Trump, or a book about Trump.
Right.
I'm not writing one of those. I do have an idea for something. It's true crime related. And I don't want to talk about it yet,
sure.
But it's after doing this for several decades. Each time I finish a book, I'm then faced with that terrible decision or figuring out what to do next. It's not something I really relish. Sometimes the ideas come, but it's also difficult now because you can't even visit any archives or speak to people or. You know, even if you contact an archive, the odds are they're not working or working one day a week.
Yeah,
and
so
it's COVID has not been good to this kind of to do writing. I wish I was just a novelist, and probably a little easier, I think. But I'd rather do nonfiction.
Yeah.
But I think I have an idea for something, and let's hope it will work out. I'll let you know soon.
As I was reading the book, you do write about going to some of these places in the present, if you will.
Yeah.
Maybe want to go back, just ache to go back to New York City.
Oh yeah, for sure. No, I can't wait to get back there. I know.
Yeah.
I knocked on. I wanted to actually get into the townhouse
on
51st,
yeah.
But I think the doctor who lives and owns the place thought I was some kind of nut. She wasn't really impressed, and nor did she like the fact that a famous murder had taken place in her apartment.
I'll bet. Yeah. Congratulations on this book, Alan. It's nice to talk again, and continue good luck with it.
All right, thank you. Thanks a lot for talking to me.
The book is called Details Are Unprintable, Wayne Lonergan and the Sensational Cafe Society Murder. It is published by Lions Press, which is an imprint of Roman and Littlefield. Visit Alan's website at alanlevinebooks.com. Alan Levine joined me on the line from Winnipeg, Manitoba. In Vancouver, I'm Joseph Planta.